Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we talk with Alison Frazier. We also review The Most Happy Fella at Encores, If Then, The Realistic Joneses, Heathers, and South Pacific at Paper Mill. Please stay tuned.
Bye bye blues. Bye bye blues. Bells ring, birds sing, sun is shining.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, April 14th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. You were out of town this week, and you were down South Carolina, were you, or...
North Carolina. South Carolina abstains courteously this time, yeah. So
you were doing your one-man show, weren't you?
Yes, I was going down there to also see a production of an obscure Molière play, which I'll be writing about in the next couple of weeks. So, yeah, a great time was had by all. So it worked out very well. Thanks.
Well, welcome back. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
With us this evening, we have a special guest. Alison Frazier is joining us from the road, where she's out with Wicked right now, and also going to tell us about her new CD, Tennessee Williams, Birds and Music. So, Alison, thanks for joining us on a Monday evening.
It's very nice to be with you, you fine fellas.
So tell us about the new CD, Tennessee Williams, Words and Music, and how did this come about?
Well, about 2 years ago, I became involved professionally with a man named David Kaplan, who's the curator of the Provincetown Tennessee Williams Festival. I pinch hit for someone who could not do a show at the festival in September, and I stepped in, and we found that we liked working with each other, and the show happened to be a big hit. And about 3 months after that, he asked me out to dinner because he had a proposition for me, and I had given him a copy of my CD, New York Romance, my first solo CD, and when I went to dinner with Mr. Kaplan, he presented me with the proposal to do a new show. I think at that time it was called the Tennessee Williams Songbook, or A Tennessee Williams Songbook. And he said he had been looking for a singer of versatility to present the songs that Tennessee Williams cherry-picked for his shows. They were basically songs that he had listened to as a child and a young man, you know, on the Victrola and the radio growing up poor in the South and lonely. And I think that he took great solace in music. And he was very emotionally invested in these songs and found places for them in the plays, the great plays that he later on came to write. I think Sweet Leilani is actually used in five different plays. So he didn't have his favorite. Apparently, Sweet Leilani was his favorite song of seduction. So we're very pleased to be including that lovely little song on this CD. And David and I found that we liked working together very much, and I was immediately enchanted with the idea. I thought it was a brilliant concept, and of course honored to be asked by such an eminent Tennessee Williams scholar and director. And he said, what would you change about this? And he handed me the order of the songs that he had proposed, how he had proposed to put them in the show. And he said, what would you change? And I just looked at it and said, you're not going to believe this, being the control freak that I am, but nothing. It's perfect. It's perfect. Because what he had done was he put the songs, which include, you know, such fantastic representations of the American songbook as If I Didn't Care, It's Only a Paper Moon, Sophisticated Lady, St. Louis Blues, San Antonio Rose, Bye Bye Blues, The Party's Over Now, which is an American songbook, obviously, because Noah Coward wrote it, but it's just a fantastic collection of songs. And what David did was he wove these songs, between these songs, select pieces of text from Tennessee Williams' plays. And what happens is that you have this Blanche archetype, that's me, and through these bits of text, and in one case, got quite a long monologue done to a background of Estrellita, exactly the way it is done in the play. I believe the play is, well, of course, it's Captain Roy Domain, and Let Me Listen. And these pieces of text and songs are done in the order that David has put them in, tell a story, and the story is very similar to the emotional trajectory of Blanche's story. So we know it doesn't change. but there is salvation at the end, so people won't want to kill themselves by the end of the album. It's okay.
So I did not see the show in Provincetown, but I saw it when Allison did it as a one-night benefit here in the city. But also, I think at one point the title was Only a Paper Moon. Isn't that right?
You know, it was Only a Paper Moon at one of the venues that we've done it at, and that was the New Orleans Festival, Tennessee Williams Festival. I'm not quite sure why they chose that title, but I think Tennessee Williams' words and music says exactly what we want to say, because Tennessee Williams' words are music. I mean, one of the great things about Tennessee Williams is that he made dialogue poetry. And I think that the music that he chose juxtaposed against it makes it even more poetic. So it's Tennessee Williams' words and music to me says exactly what this show is, because let's face it, it's an interesting concept. I'm not quite sure it's been done all that often. And some people are confused by it. I mean, I was loath to, when Ghostbite proposed that they put it out on their label, I said, great. And they said, oh, let's do it on April 1st. And I said, you know, can we delay it a week? Because when people hear this title, they might go, Tennessee Williams' words and music, April 1st, is April Fool's Day? And I didn't want any confusion whatsoever. So I'm really hoping that once they get their hands on the superb liner notes that David has written, I mean, the liner notes alone are worth the cost of the album, believe me. You know, here you have one of the finest Tennessee Williams scholars in the world, and a great writer to boot. Waxing very, very beautifully about this project that's quite dear to his heart. And the way the album came about was we had done it down in New Orleans. I think we've done it in four different places so far. And when we did it in New Orleans, I had been disappointed by a couple of record deals in New York. I didn't like the way people were talking about recording it, like, oh, we're going to do it in one day and edit it the same day. And I'm like, what? Have you heard my other albums? I'm meticulous, please. I torture editors. I won't have enough time to torture you in one day, because I'm very exacting, and I'm very hands-on in the editing process, because I want it to be perfect. So the New York deals kind of fell through. And then I said, Allison, my collaborator in this project, Allison Leighton Brown, who did the arrangements and plays such a spectacular red-hot piano and put the bands together. I said, Allison, call me crazy, but in New Orleans, we are going to have the finest musicians on the planet. We have James Singleton, for God's sake, on bass. You know, if you walk on an airplane in New Orleans, and you walk into the airport terminal, and there's a big jazz mural, and on one side is Louis Armstrong, on the other side is my bass player, James Singleton. Wow. So, you know, that's a very, very high level of musician, and Bobby Campo is absolutely superb on trumpet, and Lynn Marcel on the drums, and Jason Mingledorf on the sax. I mean, it's amazing. And of course, we brought the great trombone and ukulele player J. Walter Hawks down with us. He travels with us. Our core group is Allison Layton Brown, me, and J. Walter Hawks. Because J. Walter Hawks, as he's playing the trombone specifically, is sort of the male influence in the show. He's really sort of a Stanley figure. And he speaks harshly and softly. He seduces with his trombone, and then he castigates with his trombone, and it's kind of a wonderful musical concept, and I think people will be surprised at how incredibly articulate that trombone can be. So that's why. What I did is I said, Allison, I want to get this on tape, so you know, let's just do it. I don't care what it costs. Let's just do it. And call me crazy, but I think it's going to be a lot less expensive down there. And sure enough, it cost about a quarter of what it would have cost up here. And we had a superb studio where Harry Connick Jr. had just finished an album there. We had a lot of time. And the great thing is, besides the caliber of musicians that we had, was that we had done the show. We were doing the show for a week down there. So we had really become a band. We had rehearsed together. We had done shows together. We had partied together and really bonded. You know, we call them, in the context of the show, the gentleman callers. And we had a ball. I mean, it was New Orleans. So by the time we got to New Orleans, on Monday, we met the boys on Monday, I believe, and then we started rehearsing for the show on Wednesday night. So by the time our recording came to be, which was on Saturday, because oddly enough, this is kismet for you, we didn't have a Saturday night show. So I was like, well, this is perfect, because it's quite a wrenching show for me, because I sing the whole thing, and some of it's quite daunting vocal pyrotechnics, a lot of growling, and it's a lot of vocal work. But I didn't have to sing. I didn't have to do a show that night. So it was really a great, it was a perfect storm of events that led up to this, I think, top drawer recording.
Good. Now, Allison.
Ghostlight heard it and picked it up. Ghostlight loves it and picked it up nicely and put it out for us.
All right, Allison, let me ask you. I've seen you in many musicals, of course, but I've also seen you in many plays. I've seen you in An Oak Tree. I've seen you in Dedication. I know you did Love Lost and What I Wore. Have you ever done a Tennessee Williams play?
I actually did. I had the great, great honor of originating the part of the matron in the very last play he ever wrote, a previously, up till last year, unproduced play that he wrote in 1983, right before his death, called In Masks Outrageous and Austere. And I appeared opposite one of Tennessee Williams' favorite actresses, Shirley Knight. And it was a wild production down at the Culture Project, but And it was done at a very, you know, sad and difficult time of his life, but it was a thrill. It was a thrill to say these words and know that, oh my God, I'm debuting this play. So I really did have my year of Tennessee Williams, with appearing at the Tennessee Williams Provincetown Festival twice, and then doing In Masks Outrageous in Austere, and then starting actually 2 years. Starting this this project, Tennessee Williams Words and Music, and of course the CD. And we're really hoping that the CD generates interest to do the show again, because it's a terrific ride. It's a doorway into Tennessee Williams, you know, unique world. And if you listen to the CD, you can come through that doorway with us and experience that world. And I'm loving it. And so far, reviews have been sort of blissful, and it's just very gratifying to have a vision and see it through, and then have people respond so favorably.
So you're out right now with Wicked. You're in Tennessee right now?
I am in Nashville, and I have to say it's one of my very favorite cities all of a sudden. I'm really enjoying it, and what a great place to debut an album. Oh, my goodness. I'm in Music City.
It's a great music town,
and,
yeah.
It's a music town, and it's also a very beautiful town. There's a lot of spectacular architecture. There's a lot of, oddly enough, deco around here, and I love looking at deco office buildings. And I've started this sort of fun Instagram account. It's Allison Frazier McGee. You know, I was married to Rusty McGee for so many years before he passed away. And I call it Morrible's Travels. So every city that I go to, I just sort of take a lot of pictures and throw them up on Instagram as an abstraction of my tour. And people have been really enjoying that. It's kind of fun.
So
that's my hobby on the road.
Yeah, having being out there on the road and documenting it and launching an album, you've really filled all the extra time up that you have in between cities.
It's Wicked takes a lot of your time. It does. We're always working. We're rehearsing a lot. We're putting in a new Elphaba, which means it's a lot of rehearsal. The first and last weeks are always a little bit hectic because of the load-ins and load-outs, and just discovering a new city and getting around is, a task unto itself, but it's very gratifying, and this came at a good time in my life. I was ready to take a little bit of a break from New York, and I've always loved the show Wicked. I just think it's a terrific piece of theater, and I never thought I was sort of the right type for Marvel. And then when the opportunity came up, I think it had to do with that web series that I do called It Could Be Worse, where I play such a villainous woman, Veronica Bailey. It's the same casting director as the casting director for Wicked. Not the same casting director. The casting director played himself in It Could Be Worse. And I think he said, wait a second, she'd be a good villain. So I'm pretty sure that had a lot to do with it. And I love the part. I think she's a really, Madame Marble's a very smart woman. I think she's the second smartest woman on that stage, or person on that stage. And I think she's somebody that hit a glass ceiling and got resentful about it. And when she saw the opportunity to grab some power, grabbed it and abused it. So I find it a fascinating character to play.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us from the road and introducing us to your album. We're very excited to listen to it. And you have a great night. Thanks for joining
us.
It's
wonderful to talk to you guys.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye-bye. Been a fan of Allison's forever.
Me too.
I remember her New York Romance CD. I played it over and over and over and over. It was so good to speak with her and from the road, in fact. It's nice.
Well, I became a fan way back in 78 when I saw In Trousers at Playwrights Horizons, which had Chip Zine in it, Mary Tester in it, Allison in it, and, 3 out of 4 isn't bad. The other woman didn't have much of a career that I know of. She may be a big star in Hollywood, but nevertheless, think of the three of those people essentially just starting out and doing so well. And of course, William Finn was just starting out too. So it was quite an event.
Well, as I said, I got to see the Tennessee Williams show and in that one night benefit that Allison did here in the city. And it was just terrific. Actually, David Kaplan had discussed it with me before it was first done in Provincetown. And it's funny, as soon as he said it, I thought it sounded like a great idea. But I also really wasn't aware that there were that many songs in Tennessee Williams plays. I mean, I feel like I know his over sure. pretty well, yeah. But there are so many. I didn't realize until they were all put together in a show like that. And the way it's woven together with the bits of dialogue and monologues from the plays, it's really terrific. So I hope she keeps doing the show live, in various places. But in the meantime, I'm really looking forward to that CD.
That CD is going to make you a most happy fellow, won't it now?
Yes.
Speaking of which, Peter and Michael got a chance to see Most Happy Fella a week ago at Encores, and we skipped it last week because we were a little bit busy, but we're very interested in hear what you thought about it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Most Happy Fella?
Oh, yes, we really must discuss it because it's so fantastic. It's one of my favorite shows, especially, you know, and it's interesting. Just about 2 years ago, as I may have mentioned, I got to see two productions within like a month or two of each other right here in the city. One was done at the DiCapo Opera on the East Side, and the other one was done down at NYU by the Steinhardt School. And both of them had full orchestras, and then this amazing Encores production had a 38-piece orchestra. So I'm so spoiled I can't even tell you. You know, and God knows when it'll happen again, but I'm so glad I got to see all of those. And I'm not even mentioning I saw two separate productions by the City Opera several years apart, and then the Broadway revival in 79, which had its problems, but it also had a full orchestra. So I think that's it for the full orchestra performances I've seen, but I would say that's quite a lot. And then there was the subsequent Broadway revival, which only had two pianos and certainly had its, you know, its pluses, but I'm not going to tell you I didn't miss the orchestra, because it's just, you know, and the Don Walker orchestrations are superb, and the score is so lush and beautiful. And the Encores production was really, I would say, better than I could ever even have hoped. All of the leads were superb. It's a shame that the production happened to come at a time when it seemed like every other person in New York City was sick in one way or another. And apparently it did go through the cast in either rehearsals and or performances. Several of the people were sick. And unfortunately, you know, I think it was only really evident to me in terms of Schuller Hensley, who, I mean, he was really great, but it's not, I would say the score is not, would not be completely in his comfort level range wise anyway. It's a very high baritone role as written. And they did a number of transpositions, which was perfectly fine. But that on top of the fact that he, apparently was ill, he had to negotiate a lot of high notes at the two performances I saw. I saw the Saturday matinee and the Sunday evening. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. I got my press tickets for the final performance. And then I you know, I kind of knew this was going to be something special. So I made a point of getting a ticket on my own for Saturday afternoon. And so I got to go to the talk back, which was terrific, because Joe Sullivan, Frank Lesser's widow, and the original Rosabella was there. And Robert Kimball led the talk back. But it really was across the board just a terrific, terrific production, with Schuller as Tony Esposito and Laura Benanti just about perfection as Rosabella, Heidi Blickenstaff as Cleo, J. Armstrong Johnson, who did not sound to me like he was going to be perfectly cast, but he was, I have to say, really terrific as Herman. And it seeing him do it seemed, although a little somewhat different and younger than I've seen it done before, he didn't seem miscast to me at all. And everyone else, the incredible orchestra led by Rob Berman, musically it was really brilliant. But also I do not ever expect to see it acted better. There are two scenes towards the very end, one where Rosabella has to tell Tony that she's going to have another man's child. And then the subsequent scene where he forgives her for that. I would say that the acting in those two scenes by Schuller and Laura Benanti were equivalent to anything I've seen in the best acting of the best plays I've ever seen by Tennessee Williams or Arthur Miller or any of the great. It was you know, it was breathtaking. So I you know, and this on, you know, for what it's worth, on about 2 weeks rehearsal maybe. So really, I'm so thrilled that the Encores did it and did such an amazing, incredible job with it.
So Peter, what did you think?
Exactly the same thing, though I was really enthusiastic about Jay Armstrong Johnson, who I thought really was charming as Herman. So I liked him more than Michael. Not that Michael panned him. It's just my level of enthusiasm was higher. That's all I mean. What I find interesting, what I find fascinating, what I find compelling about The Most Happy Fella is that here's this big overture, and here's this show that had three hit songs come from it. Standing on the Corner, Big D, and Joey, Joey, Joey. And none of those songs appear in the overture. I find that really, really, well, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Because that never happens. I remember talking to Charles Strauss years ago and talking about the fact that Baby Talk to Me was the first song you really heard in the overture by Bye Birdie. I said, do you expect that to be a hit? He said, yeah, that's the one we thought. And the thing is that you know that Frank Lesser knew hit songs when he heard them, when he wrote them. And there they are. They're not there. Because I think he wanted to establish right away that this was a very serious musical. The famous statement he always made, it's a musical with a lot of music. It's not an opera. But nevertheless, there are times when it certainly reaches into operatic stratospheres, and we're glad when it does. So that's of more than moderate interest to me. Now, the other thing I want to bring up is that right now, as we speak, at Pan Asian Repertory Company, there is a play called Fishing for Wives. And the press release says, Nishi, tired of life as a single fisherman, sends for a picture bride from his native Japan, but includes a photo of his handsome friend in his place.
Ah.
The bride arrives and falls in love with the wrong bachelor. Well, I can't wait to hear such songs as Joey's Son, Joey's Son, Joey's Son. Bowing in the Corner, Bowing as the Girls Go By, The Most Happy and Honorable Feller, and my personal favorite, Big T, Little O, Little KYO. You know, I mean, so I'm amazed that this play, I guess I'm going to go see it just because of that. Of course, Frank Lesser borrowed the plot, too. He borrowed his from the Pulitzer Prize winning play, They Knew What They Wanted, which was done here in the late 70s at the Phoenix Rep in Rep with Arthur Miller plays and Tennessee Williams plays, one of which Meryl Streep was in. And seeing They Knew What They Wanted really made you have even more respect for Frank Lesser, because there's so much political talk in that play. Mm. And the fact that he really eradicated that and really made it flow very well. Because don't forget, Lesser wrote the book on this one, too. It's one of the reasons it took him 6 years. His musicals really didn't take that long to get on. But this one did, because he had so much to do. And certainly did it well. And obviously he did not settle for less, as we can easily see. So, yes, Shula Hensley finessed the notes. Yes, Laura Bernanti was wonderful beyond belief. Yes, indeed, Cheyenne Jackson cut an imposing figure as Joey. And Heidi Blickenstaff, so many people have compared her to Susan Johnson. I don't know what could be a higher compliment. So I've also heard a rumor they're bringing it back in some form. I don't know what that means. I don't know if they're going to bring it back to Encores. I don't know if there's a production plan. I don't think so. I get the impression from the rumor, that's all it is, that I've heard, is that Encores is going to bring it back. Now, if that never happens, don't be the slightest bit surprised. I don't tell you what I tell you is true. I only tell you what I hear. So we'll see what happens there.
That is exciting. And I can't believe that I forgot to mention Jessica Mulaski, who was so great as Tony's sister, Marie.
Yes, she was, because she wasn't, you know, this
stereotypical.
Harridan. You know, that's what made her special, that she really did have her brother's best interest in mind. But all this stuff that's in here about the influence that parents and siblings have on you, that they can really do a job on you. They can really make you feel inferior. Mm. I'm not saying this happens in every family, and I'm not coming down on families, and this is not my damnation of mothers, fathers, sisters, and brothers across the board. I'm only saying that it's established here that so much behavior is determined by Tony, Mama wouldn't want you to, and Mama, and a lot of talk about that. Yeah, you know? And he really feels a lot of pressure, even though his mother is dead. The fact is, she's still alive in many ways for him. So that's that really is a compelling part of The Most Happy Feller as well.
Boy, that's interesting what you said about the Pan-Asian rep play. I mean, of course, Happy Fella, you know, borrows, if you want to use that word, the plot from They Knew What They Wanted. But, I mean, it's credited.
Yes, it sure is.
So I guess that's a big difference. But, gee, that sounds
well, really I'm still waiting for Arthur Lawrence to give Shakespeare credit in Romeo and Juliet on West Side Story. It hasn't happened yet. But you know Arthur, but that's another story. Anyway.
So, Most Happy Fella, perhaps we'll get a chance to see it again, you know?
Maybe we will. You know, I don't know. It's not the most reliable source I heard it from, but, you know,
the
who knows?
Sad thing is, of course, I don't think it could ever economically be feasible on Broadway unless it had, you know, someone starring in it who shouldn't be starring in it, you know, because they were a really big star, but they just, you know, I mean, I can't think of any major stars who could ever do any of those two major roles. So who knows, maybe Encores now has, they stopped their Summer Stars series as such, but mm-hmm. now they have this Encores off center. Is that what it's? Yeah. And they're going to be doing a Tick Tick Boom, and what are the other two?
Faust.
Yes.
Faust is definitely in there. And is it Pump Boys? I don't know. Is that what
it
was?
Yeah. But maybe they'll slip this in. Maybe they'll slip a Happy Fella reprise in over the summer. That would be so wonderful. I'll be there again.
Yes, you will. I know you will. You went twice in one day. That's really something.
No, not 2 days. Saturday matinee and Sunday evening.
Uh-huh.
If we to write it down on paper, if Most Happy Fella came back, then Michael Portantier would be at it. Which brings us to our next play.
Yes.
If Then. Michael and Peter got a chance to see If Then. I'm actually going to go see it this week. So, Michael, Peter, why don't you start us off with If Then?
Fine. What's the word I'm looking for? You know, I'll tell you the truth. I'm looking to avoid the word interesting because John Marsh tells me I use it too much. But anyway, so fill in your own word to describe. But what brought me to If Then was that it was the grandson of Company, in the sense that it really talked about New York life. It was very centered in the first act, especially. A lot of good jokes from Brian Yawkey about New York life, lots of them. But he has more in his mind than that. What he has on his mind is fate versus choice and what happens to people, that their roads, the road you didn't take, the road you did take. That's what the whole show's about. Idina Menzel plays either Beth or Liz, depending on what scene she's in, what road she took. Sometimes she wears glasses, sometimes she doesn't. Sometimes the lights are a certain color to indicate that she's taken one road, sometimes they aren't. It's still a little confusing, but if you really stay with it, you'll get it. But what's good about this show is that there's so much that's very organic to it, that so much of it does center on fate versus choice. There's talk about you never know, odds are, you know, it's a sign, it's meant to be, life can change around the next corner, all those things. That comes up over and over and over again. And I think that's really good to have so many expressions in the show that we use all the time. And it really reiterates the fact that this is a real life story, that we all, who of us doesn't think about the road we didn't take? I can't imagine there's anybody who doesn't. Years ago when Barrymore was on Broadway, I've never forgot the line that Christopher Plummer had. I'll paraphrase it, but I still remember the concept, which was, a man knows he's getting old when his dreams turn to regrets. It's a good line. And that's part and parcel of what goes on in If Then, too. Idina Menzel's fine. Yes, she is. She's very good. She certainly has a fan base. We know that. I'm not going to say that I think she deserves the Tony. That has a lot to do with my seeing Lady Day and Audrey McDonald. And I know she has five, and I don't care. But I don't. You know, I think she deserves sixth, though I haven't seen Bullets Over Broadway yet. But it's a solid performance. She does the role very, very well. I have no more to say about her than that. I think she did what she was asked to do. Music, fine, contemporary, sounds right for the characters. Tom Kitt did fine work there. Brian Yorke, again, doing the lyrics, sure. He's one of our best. So it's a solid evening in the theater. I wish it were a little clearer so I could have got more involved with it. Also, it gets terribly, terribly severe in the second act. Something happens that's terribly dramatic and casts quite a pall over the evening. But it shows that the authors aren't pulling their punches, so I have to give them credit there as well.
Michael, what did you think about it?
Well, I guess I had the opposite reaction to the continual statement of the theme. I thought it got to be quite ridiculous after maybe the second or third song. And as the friend who I went with said, boy, if you don't get the theme of this show, you got to be an idiot. But I, you know, it just seemed dunning to me over and over and over again. My reaction was, in general, that I thought the score itself, you know, the songs themselves were really quite good. Not surprising from the people who wrote Next to Normal, not at all surprising, but I would say that I almost could not believe that the book was by the same person, namely Brian Yorke, because I not only to me was it very confusing to try to keep track of which path of her life you were following at each individual moment, but ironically to me, what happened in each story was so ridiculous in and of itself that I mean, there were places where I was like laughing in disbelief. I can't tell you how ridiculous a lot of the plot points were. In one life she falls into this job as this major job as like an urban planner of the city of New York, based apparently on almost no qualifications whatsoever, as she says herself. There's a point where she she hands in her resignation for this job about which she feels ambivalent from the very beginning. And then suddenly her friend LaChance arrives. And I think she mentions to her, the Idina Menzel character, about how she had cited her as an American female hero to her kindergarten class. And apparently that is enough to for Idina Menzel's character to tell her boss you can rip up my letter of resignation. There was all of these things where I'm like, what is going on? They have her involved, sexually involved in one or both stories with almost every male character on the stage, including her boss, played by Jerry Dixon, in one version. And that I thought was, you know, it just seemed like that was a completely unnecessary plot point. Just one thing after another.
I address this, Michael? The thing about she's not qualified for the job. What does happen in the show is that Jerry Dixon continues to say, you're right for this, you're the one. And I've seen that happen in life, that a lot of people really believe other people can do jobs and hire them on the basis of what they believe. So I bought that. That doesn't make me right, but I did buy it.
Well, I would say I agree with that as a general statement, but and this major job as a major urban planner of New York City?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm only saying that that's the way it struck me.
Well, anyway, I wrote a page of things that happened in the plot that seemed completely ridiculous to me. I won't bore you with all of them. But you know what I think? I think they made a big mistake in the general concept of the two paths that her life take, because what I think they should have done is that one of her lives would have taken her to another place with another completely different set of friends and lovers, if so. Because what we see here is, you know, Anthony Rapp and LaChance and Jerry Dixon and Jason Tam and most of the leads are in both versions of her life in one way or another. And that only added to the confusion. Whereas if it had been two different sets of people, I think that would have aided tremendously in keeping them straight. And that also would have made her two lives all the more different. So I think that, it's too late now, but in one version she should have the show opens in both versions with her coming back or to New York City for the first time.
Coming back, I think.
Yeah. After being in Seattle.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. For a while. So I think that maybe in one version she should have gone back to Seattle, for example.
I like that. That's good.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And also, don't you think that having the same people for the most part in both of her lives just made it even more confusing?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, the Seattle idea is a very good one, Michael. Good for you, because, also the change of scenery would have helped us tremendously with projections to see where we were, I think that's a very good idea. And, Lord knows the road you didn't take does mean literal roads from time to time. And the road to Seattle would have been a very good one.
And they weren't. Thank you. And they weren't. They tried, but they weren't completely consistent with her, with the glasses on and the glasses off, because I guess no one wears glasses all the time. Mm. And even the lighting scheme, I don't think that was 100% consistent. At least
I agree. Yeah.
So that's what I wish they had done. I do like the score. And would like to hear the album, but I'm very surprised. To me, it was so confused and so many characters and so many weird plot points that I'm surprised that they didn't clean it up by the time it got to Broadway.
All right, so I guess we'll leave it at that for right now. I'm going to see it, as I mentioned, later on this week. We'll talk about it next week again, see if which side I've come down on.
That's right, yeah.
Maybe I'll come down on a third leg of the stool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. All three of us got a chance to see The Realistic Joneses. So, Peter, why don't you start us off?
No, James, why don't you go first, since all three of us are.
Yes,
go ahead.
Well, I hate to shape a conversation.
You won't.
Frankly,
I'll tell the listeners that I know what James thought of it, because as he came up the aisle at the end of the show, what did you say to me?
It had an intermission.
Intermission, right? Yeah.
if it had an intermission, I wouldn't have been back for the second half.
You would have been in the night air.
I would have been gone.
Yeah.
There was another show this season where we had really great talent on the stage, and as much as they were trying as hard as they could to make something of this material, they couldn't do it. And I can't remember what other show it was, but that's the way I really felt about The Realistic Joneses. It had some funny one-liners here and there, but what the hell was it? It was disjointed and all over the place. And what was the point of it? And I just didn't get it. And I really enjoyed all four of the actors up on stage there, and
they're in a different show. That's
yeah, awesome. Exactly. So, what did you think about this? Did this play have a point to it more than I missed?
Well, I do think that it's meant to be a type of absurdist play, and I also think that it deals with the absurdity of modern life and the crazy that we're all crazy people. I mean, and I think that's what he's getting at here. It reminded me of a benign David Mamet, there wasn't profanity, but there was interrupted dialogue and a lot of dialogue that just struck me as very true to life. And I mean this as a compliment. So David Mamet without the profanity. But it was the absurdity of the situation that kept on raising his head. Now, of course, there's a very serious underbelly to this play because two of the men in this play have very difficult things to deal with. And that deals with a terrible illness. I won't quite say that I understand what that illness is, but I certainly it's not a good one. And because they've had to come to a town where there's a specialist who may very well be able to help them and may not. And their wives have to put up with this too. And the thing is that the older gentleman who is played by Tracy Letts, yes, that same Tracy Letts who we were so impressed with, not only as an actor in Virginia Woolf, but of course as the writer of August Osage County. And the other gentleman is Michael C. Hall, an actor who has been a, the master of ceremonies in Cabaret, ironically enough, and Billy Flynn in Chicago. But he has a Hollywood career as well. And but Tracy Letts has been suffering longer. And what you see is that Michael Hall's character, he's looking at previews of coming attractions. But there are fascinating lines in it, like ice cream is a dish best served cold. Now, of course, what he's talking about, it's a play on that famous line, revenge is a dish that's best served cold. And what's wonderful about Will Eno is that he has a wonderful way of looking at language, and his perceptions are definitely off the wall. But nevertheless, I'll be willing to look at that wall, because every time he does a show, there is something in it that intrigues me. I'm not saying that this works as a conventional play. No, I won't say that. But what I will say is that there are enough ideas in it, enough intelligence, enough point of view to make me arrestingly into it.
I absolutely agree with that. Michael, what did you think about it?
Well, my first Will Eno play that I ever saw was just a couple of months ago, The Open House at Signature Theater. Mm-hmm. And then I saw this one, which was my second Will Eno play. And I will say, first of all, that what I really appreciate is that I think he can be extremely funny. And I guess maybe what I think is that I appreciate absurdist comedy more than absurdist drama in general, and also in these two plays. Although actually I like The Open House better overall. I thought it had more of a clear point to me. As far as the point of this one, James, I'm sort of with you. The only thing I could think of is that I assume maybe it has some thing to do with keeping up with the Joneses. I don't think that the title is a coincidence. It's about these two, you know, couples named Jones, living either next door or right down the road from each other in what do they call it, a smallish town not far from some mountains. And the keeping up with the Joneses, I mean, I guess maybe that was the point. There were a couple of ways in which that maybe was reflected. The fact that it's revealed right from the beginning that the character played by Tracy Letts has this rare, apparently pretty bad disease. And then only later is it revealed that Michael C. Hall's character also supposedly has it. So is that supposed to be keeping up with the Joneses? I mean, does he really have it, or is he just saying that? You know, and then the other thing is that Michael C. Hall becomes romantically sexually involved with Tracy Letts' character's wife, played by Toni Collette. And then the other two don't actually become involved as far as we see. But there is like some reference to interest in doing so. If it was supposed to be keeping up with the Joneses, I thought maybe there could have been more examples of that, unless I missed some. But if that's not the point, then I'm not really sure what it is other than just the absurdity of life and the absurdity of how sometimes everyday dialogue, when you kind of step back and look at it, can be really kind of weird. So that's as much help as I can give as to what the point was.
It never occurred to me about Keeping Up with the Joneses, and I'm sure you're 100% correct on that. That's got to be what it is. You know, since both of them are named Jones, in both couples. You know, so good for you. I didn't think of that.
Well, or maybe he just meant because it's such a generic name. Other than Smith, it's, you know,
sure,
it's the
sure.
most. But I would love to ask him if that was the point, because I don't get it.
So have you guys seen Tony Collette, but Marissa Tomei in other things on stage?
For me, only Salome. And wasn't she in that awful?
Wait Until Dark. Yeah. Wait Until Dark. And I think she's done stuff off Broadway. I will say this, that when I was in working the Tony red carpet one night, I spoke to Tony Collette. It was when the Wild Party was happening, and her accent from Australia has nothing to do with the accent that you're hearing on stage.
Yeah.
She's really terrific in masking that and really sounding like an American.
So I can't remember. I saw Wait Until Dark, but I don't remember Marissa in it.
It really was not a good. Do you remember?
No.
Do you remember?
Quentin Tarantino. Is that what you?
Yeah.
Mean?
Yes. Yeah. Do you remember him?
Yeah. But I felt like in the Realistic Joneses, in the beginning of the show, I wasn't sure what she was doing. It was like she was doing voices, or her voice was, you know, like voiceover characters or cartoons or something like that, because she had distinctly different voices that she was speaking in. And I was like, what's going on here? She's a very good actress, and I didn't understand what
Marissa?
She was doing.
Oh, yeah. Well, she seemed like a very kind of one of those self-aware characters who's like, you know, kind of joking and acting a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I got from it.
All right, so let's move forward beyond the Realistic Joneses, and we'll go into Heathers, where Peter and Michael got a chance to see it. In fact, Peter just got back moments ago from it. So Peter, fresh in your mind, why don't you tell us about Heathers?
It's a very good adaptation of the film. It's tremendously strong. It pleased its audience immeasurably. It's not a show that I'm crazy about per se, but I will say that there's going to be an audience for this show, and I'm amazed that it's at New World Stages, because there are so many people in it. I've often heard that really 6 to 9 is about as high as you can go off Broadway, but boy, there's got to be like 19 in this one. And very well done indeed. Smart lyrics, which is really nice to hear, because usually in shows that mock teenagers, they go to a very low level, and not here at all. Very surprising concepts. For those who haven't seen the movie or the musical, for that matter, this is about three girls named Heather. But more to the point, it's about a girl who wants to be a Heather, because the Heathers are the most beautiful girls in the school. They're the most popular. And that's what this is. This is an extension of the wicked thing about popular. There's Veronica Sawyer, who wants to be in the in crowd and gets to be in the in crowd because she does something. I don't want to use the word illegal, because we're talking about high school, but she does get the girls out of potential trouble. And as a result, they are going to reward her by letting her become part of the group. Although she's always a bit on the outside. Some of that is because they make her very clear that we're training you. But the other thing, too, is that she has reservations about who these girls are. Yes, she wants to be in with the in crowd, but she still wants to be her own person. And when they want to do terrible things, and they do, she doesn't want any part of that. So she hooks up with a guy named Jason Dean. And this is a very clever idea, because he mentions he's had 10 homes in the last 6 years, I think it is. And so the only thing he can really depend on is 7-Eleven. Because everywhere he goes, there's 7-Eleven, and he gets a Slurpee. I know that sounds silly, but in a way, there's something to be said for that, that these are the constants when people have to move a lot, and he has to move a lot because of his father and his mother's dead. So we really care about this boy. And yet, as time goes on, we find out he's no angel. And the real struggle has to do with whether or not Veronica is going to stay with him, because he gets her into a lot of trouble. And he's not particularly sorry that he does. So music, sure, pop rock. I will say that every song was greeted as if it were Who's That Woman from Follies. The audience really went crazy for it. So I think it's a big hit. And because it's intelligent, because it never panders, because you really see the motivations of these characters and they make sense, I wish it well.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, let me say, first of all, I thought the score was terrific. I really, really liked it a lot. Interesting credit on this show. It's book, music, and lyrics by Kevin Murphy and Lawrence O'Keefe, in that order. I checked back, and you know, just to refresh my memory, but Legally Blonde, which was another score that I really liked, was music by Lawrence O'Keefe and Nell Benjamin, his wife, lyrics by Lawrence O'Keefe and Nell Benjamin, and then book by Heather Hawk. So I'm not sure, you know, so, I mean, it's just interesting that the this is credited thusly. And Kevin Murphy, is that the fellow we know, Peter, from If It Only Even Runs a Minute?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Or is that a different, his name, he's called Kevin Michael Murphy, isn't it?
Was that right?
Maybe okay. It's a different, maybe I should have checked. I'm sorry. Well, anyway, I really thought the score was great. Actually, just today, there was a press release about a cast recording. So I'm going to be looking forward to that. And I also think from what I remember of the film, which I have not seen since it came out, I agree with Peter that it's a very good adaptation in terms of preserving the general tone, you know, of it. But I have to say, as I was saying to James before we started recording tonight, maybe it's just world events. I mean, this story is partly, it involves one high school student shooting two others. It involves a high school girl attempting to kill herself by jumping off a building. And I think maybe that things have just happened since then that makes that, to me, really unpalatable in a basically lighthearted musical. I mean, it's certainly dark in places, but I mean, there's a lot of kind of ironic humor involved in the murders, and yes, absolutely, the attempted suicide, they do treat that completely seriously, but even that, I don't know, it seemed like a bit of a cop out because first of all, the girl doesn't die, which she doesn't die in the film either, I believe, but the whole thing made me very uneasy. Just that subject matter, seeing it nowadays, I did not have that reaction when I saw the movie, but as I say, it was so long ago and so much has happened.
So much has happened since then, indeed.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even want to mention Columbine.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
but,
right.
But,
I know.
So I would like to see the movie again, which of course, was the first big splash of, I would say, Christian Slater, on screen. So that really put him on the map, and it was Winona Ryder in the central, the girl who wants to be the Heather. I hope to catch up with the movie again sometime, but in the meantime, let me just say again how much I thought the score was really terrific.
So while you were chatting, I looked it up. Kevin Michael Murphy from If It Only Even Runs a Minute. I always get that wrong.
It's a tough title.
It's different. But it gives a great segue because the next episode of If It Only Even Runs a Minute is next Monday night at Studio 54, at 54 Below, excuse me.
Oh, thanks for mentioning that, guys. I sort of lost track of
April
it.
April 21st, 2014, 54 Below, of course, the connection to Jen Tepper, Jennifer Ashley Tepler. So everybody can drink now. They have do you know there's a Jennifer Ashley Tepper drinking game? Every time we say her name on the podcast, people drink. So
a lot of very drunk people. Certainly not out of despair.
Celebration.
Celebration, yes.
Absolutely. So 54 Below, next Monday night, 9:30, doors open at 8:45, tickets on sale 646-476-3551. But it's actually a different person from Heather's. That is Kevin Murphy, who seems to be a... he's got a lot of TV credits and a lot of Hollywood credits and things like that.
Did Reefer Madness.
Yes, exactly, Reefer Madness. So,
thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that cough. Excuse me. So let's move forward here. And Michael hopped over the river to Paper Mill Playhouse and saw South Pacific. And tell us about it.
It was better than I could ever have expected or imagined. Did I say that about Happy Fellow before? Well, it applies to this too. It was so, so good. Peter, I hope you get to see it. and James, I hope you get to see it too. It's the same sets, basically, as the Lincoln Center production, that amazing production, which revivified the show for a whole new generation, I think it's fair to say. But quite different direction by Rob Ruggiero, and I think in many respects for the better. I thought that that Doug Carpenter, who played Cable, was vastly superior to anyone I saw do it in the other production. And I think that was mostly because of the whole take that Bartlett Sher had a very strange take on that character, which I'm happy to say was not present in this production. And Doug Carpenter acted it beautifully, aside from singing it so well. The star of this was Aaron Mackey, who we were lucky enough to have on the podcast just a few weeks ago. I believe it was before she was even announced for this production, but we had her on because she was Joanna in the New York Philharmonic performances of Sweeney Todd. But she was so, so good as Nellie. She seemed so authentic to me that it was really like that was that actual person was on the stage there. There was no artifice. There was no slight even perception that she was acting, you know, and performing, even though, I mean, it's a musical. So, you know, it's kind of obviously very stylized, if only in that sense. She was so in the moment and so brilliant. She was the best Nellie I've ever seen, and I don't ever expect to see anyone do it better. Mike McGowan was Emil, and he was terrific. He apparently he was not the original. He was not originally cast. It was an opera singer from Wales named Jason Howard, who I heard secondhand wasn't able to do it because he couldn't get a visa or something like that. And Mike McGowan, I guess I just felt that he was miscast physically and somewhat vocally too. I was trying to remember where I'd seen him before, and I saw him some years ago at Bay Street Theater in the Hamptons as Captain Walker in Tommy. Now that's a pretty high rock tenor role, and this is a classic musical theater based baritone. And considering, I mean, he must have an amazing range because he did a very good job with it, but it still seemed a little too tenor-y for me. And that coupled with the fact that Doug Carpenter was more baritonal than most Cables I've seen, there wasn't that much contrast between their singing. And I thought that was a bit of an issue. But overall, I mean, so good. Loretta Ablis Sayre, or who created the role of Bloody Mary in the Lincoln Center production, it's rare, I think, very, very rare for me to see someone doing a role for that long, that many performances, and actually improving from the get-go. But that was true of her. She was great from the beginning, but now it's like I would say she owns the part, certainly for our generation. And let's see. Tally Sessions was equally fantastic as Billis. Just really, you know, really good. I've seen him do lots of different types of roles and just as good in this one. So, let's see, choreographed by Ralph Perkins, directed again by Rob Ruggiero, who I have to mention again, because it was one of the great nights in the theater for me, really.
Well, Doug Carpenter, I saw it in September, playing essentially a greaser in a musical that was in one of the festivals. Life is But a Dream was the name of the show, jukebox musical. And he really had a wonderful quality, a wonderful sensitivity as this motorcycle-y type guy. Okay, fine. The next month, there he is at Symphony Space singing Kurt Vile, and it turns out he won a competition. I mean, you don't expect that from a guy who's playing a greaser in a show. I mean, he was excellent in Life is But a Dream, and he was terrific, of course, in this concert on October 7th. And I'm amazed, you know, because I didn't associate him with Kurt Vile at all when he was doing this jukebox musical with songs from the 50s and 60s. So I think he has a very good future ahead of him, and I'm not at all surprised to hear that you liked him so much, Michael.
Well, I don't think I had ever heard of him until they were doing Most Happy Fella again at Goodspeed. Just what, like 6 months ago, maybe? Yeah. Not much more than that. Yeah. And I had seen some video and I thought, wow, who was this guy? Because he was Joey. And in that and here, maybe somewhat less so here, but he displays an opera quality. Yeah. Bass baritone, but also a bass baritone, but with ringing high notes. That repeated high note, it's twice repeated in Younger Than Springtime, was the chills went through me, and he's really the real deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to make sure that those who have the ability, get over and get thee to the Paper Mill Playhouse. So that's about it for this week. Do you guys have anything that you want to talk about that's coming up?
I'm looking forward to Bullets Over Broadway, certainly.
Yeah.
I'm certainly looking forward to Of Mice and Men, too, and seeing how Violet turned out and Annapurna. So it'll be a nice week.
Oh, you know, Jeannie Tesori. Just wrote this on Facebook, and it's very clever. I wanted to share it with everybody. It says, Sutton Foster's pilot got picked up. Annie Baker wins the Pulitzer Prize for drama. Sam Gold directed her play in our musical, Fun Home. Lisa Crone and I are finalists, as is Lisa's wife, Madeline George. Mm-hmm. Madeline's play was directed by Lee Silverman, who directed Violet opening Sunday at the American Airlines Theater. And Violet is being played by Sutton Foster. See above. So it's this big circle of life.
do either of you know the Annie Baker connection offhand?
Annie Baker went the Pulitzer Prize.
You mean with them, you mean? Yeah, I don't.
Oh. Oh, okay, but
I think the Jeannie tied it up with these women, Lord, these women.
I see. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
She wrote, oh, excuse me. And then she wrote, oh, and Sam. So Sam Gold. So
did you guys read? This is so wonderful. And I don't know, to me this sounds unprecedented. The Mint Theater's off-Broadway production of London Wall is going to be filmed for PBS.
Yeah. Wasn't that?
Yes.
Something?
Isn't that amazing?
I can't think of a single other off-Broadway show that's ever been, you know, presented in that fashion on PBS. Not within, you know,
no,
in
such a
modern
small
times
thing.
Anyway.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I mean, I know
wonderful
I love it.
Step forward to the Mint. Wonderful step forward for the Mint.
Really,
which deserves
really.
Every step forward it ever gets. So good for them.
All righty. So we'll wrap up and start by saying that if you want to subscribe to these recordings, you can go to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to it in iTunes. You can listen to it on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And you can stream This Week on Broadway directly to that device. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m.
Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me could be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Good night. The evening sun go down. Since my baby, he done left this town. Feeling tomorrow just like I feel today. I'm gonna feel tomorrow just like I feel today. I'm gonna pack my trunk, make my getaway.